morning, but I think we've got everybody here for our first case, which is Ware versus Trinivasan, if I pronounced that correctly. And it's Ms. Robinson and Fitzgerald?
Yes, sir. Okay.
All right, Ms. Robinson, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. 4 minutes, perhaps. And good morning, Your Honors. The Ware versus Srinivasan case is a divorce that took place in Henlico Circuit Court. And as a divorce case, I ask the court to please consider the following as to our petition for appeal. Berryhill versus Berryhill, which is a 2007 case that was decided by this court, has one primary factor in terms of its ruling. The ruling in the Berryhill case addresses 20-107.1F. 20-107.1F directs the trial court to have a list of findings and or conclusions in making its decision in particularly divorce matters and divorce matters affecting the, well, the obvious word is the funds or the money of the case. And we have stated and cited the Berryhill case in our opening brief. In our trial court's decision, particularly when you look at the January 19th, 2016 opinion letter, you have, Your Honors, some of the findings and some of the conclusions, but you have a definite void and you have an absence of the application.
Let me ask this question, if I might, Ms. Robinson. This whole case revolves around whether the amount of spousal support that the trial court awarded is appropriate. Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a very fair statement, sir, and at the same time a broad statement. But yes, sir,
well,
it is a fair statement.
For whatever reason, you elected not to include the transcript of the trial in the appendix. So we're kind of flying blind in that we don't really know what evidence was presented, and it makes it very difficult to determine whether the trial court's award was supported by the evidence.
The trial court's award was not supported entirely by the evidence, particularly.
I know you think that, but how do we determine that if we don't have the trial transcript?
But I believe it was initially eliminated because we only used certain portions of the trial court's transcript, sir. But then we went back, and I believe the entire transcript was included, particularly since it was a part of what the appellee wanted to have included in the appendix. So we do have in the appendix the final decree as well as the transcript.
That's a transcript of the March 28th.
Yeah. Of the March 28th,
but
yes.
It's not there's no transcript of the trial where the court heard the evidence upon which it made its decision.
Well, sir, we identified those requisite pages from the transcript that...
But you only identified three pages.
Three pages, yes. And those three pages are the most germane pages from the, I believe it was the October 2015 trial itself. Those are the telling pages. That plus the opinion letter of January 19th of 2016. Though that is exactly where all of the findings should have been made.
Counsel, at least part of your argument on the motion to rehear appeared to be that although the court considered at least some of the factors, if not all of the factors, the equity of the situation, given the length of the marriage, given what your client had given up in terms of her career to further her husband's career, to be consistent with the cultural norm, his cultural norms, things like that, dictated a different result. It didn't strike me that you were making the argument that he hadn't considered the factors. It was just that having considered the factors, he weighed them inappropriately. Is that a fair characterization of the argument?
That is a very fair assessment of the argument, sir. The discretion of the trial court, in our opinion, as appellant, was a little abusive. And I use the words little abusive because there were certain factors, and if we look at 20-107.1F, which takes us back to subsection E, there's a tick list of all the factors that should be considered there. And if you look particularly at factor 10, factor 11, factor 12, and factor 13, they are missing from the opinion letter of January 19th, as well as missing from the...
Don't we have case law, Ms. Robinson, that says the trial court, as long as he indicates he's considered all the factors, he doesn't have to specifically go through each one and say exactly how he's weighing them?
He does not have to list each and every factor, but there is nowhere where it says in the opinion letter, which was incorporated into the final decree, that all the factors were considered. For example, sir, one of the very important factors is this was a housewife for almost 19 years during the marriage, 17 years to the date of separation. And as a housewife, she did not have employment. One of the primary factors which was omitted was how long she had been out of the employment market or the job market. That was never even a consideration, which is a primary factor in one of those, number 10, I believe.
Ms. Robinson, this takes me back to my initial concern. You're telling us the facts of the case as you perceive them to be presented, but we don't have the transcript to determine whether, in fact, that's a correct assessment of the facts, or whether there's other evidence in the record that would be more germane to the court's decision. So, I mean, I come back to the same thing. I just don't understand how in the world we can determine whether a trial court abused its discretion when we don't know what evidence was presented to the trial court.
The facts of the case, sir, are repeated in the opinion letter as findings and conclusions. Regardless of what the transcript said, or even could have said, it is the argument against as to the discretion of the trial court as reported in this opinion letter as adopted and incorporated into the final decree. Even if this court had the entire transcript, it is what is extracted from that transcript that becomes the important factor that gives this court and the appellant the opportunity to ask for a reversal.
Is the argument that everything we need to decide the case regarding facts, regarding the court's weighing of the factors and statements, regarding spousal support, that it considered the factors in 108.1, its statement earlier that it applies the factors from 107 when it was doing the equitable distribution. Everything is there, and it just goes back to your equity argument that it's a matter of weighing.
Yes, sir. It's a matter of weighing. And explaining the weighing in the opinion letter, and again, it's incorporated by the final decree. It's a matter of balancing. We have a family that the trial court, in its opinion letter, stated had an upper middle class lifestyle. But when you have the application of that as reported by the trial court, still only giving the wife, the appellant in this case, $4,500 per month in spousal support, how does the court, in its opinion and its letter, come to that figure? Because that is only $54,000 per year in terms of annual income. If you weigh what the trial court said again in its opinion letter, the appellee earns $258,000 per year, which means extracting the 54 that is applied on the equity side that is given to the appellant, the appellee still retains $204,000 of his earned income.
But the limitation of, I assume you recognize the limitation on the argument you're making, is if we read the opinion letter and don't conclude that no trial judge could have reached that conclusion, then you lose. Do you accept that?
I think I have to accept that, Judge Russell, yes. I think I would have to accept that. But I'm asking the court not to go that route, obviously, which is why we're here today.
Understood.
And why the appellant has obviously appealed her case. Because weighing all of the equities, not knowing how you got to those amounts. In other words, the $4,500 per month was and appeared to have been extracted from numbers, just sheer numbers that the trial court affixed to its decision. But how you get to those numbers is a mystery.
Well, weren't those numbers presented at trial? Wasn't financial information concerning earnings and needs presented at trial?
Some of it was, but most of it was by agreement, which is recited in the opinion letter. The agreement was that the appellee did earn $258,000 a year. That was the foundation for the entire trial. There was not that much, if any, evidence presented at the time of the trial to actually prove that, because we agreed during the first 10 minutes of the trial.
Can I ask you about something? You said that since it was agreed he made $258,000 a year,
yes,
he had $204,000 left after the $54,000 in spousal support. But,
yes,
but he had to pay child support as well as medical expenses and some other things that he was supposed to pay 71% and she 29%, right? So, I mean, really, he didn't really have $204,000 left.
How does the court wish for me to respond? My red light is on you. Because I do have a response to, but I don't know.
Go ahead and respond to Judge, yes, Beal's comment, and I think your time is up.
Yes, sir. That is true, but that is only partially true, Your Honor. And when I say that it's only partially true, this is what I mean. When awarding the $4,500 per month for spousal support, there is an award of $1,118 thereabout for child support. But in that award, that's going to end pretty soon. And the court also decided and gave the appellant additional bills as well. For example, those additional costs that will be coming out of the $4,500 per month health care, and she already had a pre-existing condition, which is cited in the opinion letter as well. She had deep vein thrombosis. Which
I think we've given you time to respond. Thank you very much for your argument.
Yes, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Kimberly Fitzgerald on behalf of the Friedman Law Firm, and I represent Sudarshan and Srinivasan, the appellee in this matter. I think it's clear from the opinion letter and the appendix that the trial court did appropriately consider all of the factors, and there's simply no grounds that rise to the level of abuse of discretion of the trial court.
Do you agree that the opinion letter gives us all the necessary facts and factors to reach the argument that this was an inequitable situation?
I agree that based on the opinion letter, this court can see that the trial court properly considered all of the factors. I do think that it would be helpful for this court if the entire transcript was included, but I think that there is what's necessary in the opinion letter.
Thank you.
I also think it's important to point out that the appellant incorrectly framed her assignment of error as a reduction. The trial court's decision, it was an initial determination, the pendente lite order has no precedential value, and that's the Scarberry versus Scarberry case. I also think it's important to note that the appellant acknowledged it was correct for the court to impute her $30,000 per year, so that she acknowledged that the imputation of income was correct. And there really just is no basis for this court to find an abuse of discretion. We also, in our brief, asked this court to award attorney's fees to the appellee. Does the court have any questions on the legal issue before I address the issue of attorney's fees? I think there's clear precedent that when there's no good faith basis for an appeal, that this court has the ability to award attorney's fees, and we're asking the court, pursuant to the O'Loughlin versus O'Loughlin case, to remand the issue of attorney's fees back to the trial court. I think it's important in this case not just that there's no good faith basis for the spousal support issue, but there's a couple other important things to note. The first is that there were originally five assignments of error in this single appeal. The appellee incurred costs for us to review all of those assignments. Four of them were withdrawn. In addition, there's actually four appeals that have been filed as all part of this divorce case. The first one was an appeal of a quadro that was agreed to on the record. That was withdrawn. The second one was an appeal regarding a finding of contempt against the wife for failing to pay the guardian's fee. That appeal was dismissed by this court because the transcript wasn't filed. The appellant has since filed two motions to reconsider with this court, basically alleging that it was appellee's counsel's fault that the transcript wasn't filed. So again, Mr. Srinivasan is incurring costs for all these appeals. This is a third appeal, and then a fourth appeal was just filed regarding an order entered in the trial court regarding the sale of the house. It was not a final order. It was a temporary order, and it's just been appealed. So,
did we consider that in deciding whether to award attorney's fees in this appeal, or is that something we should defer to a later time when that appeal reaches us?
Honestly, Judge, I tried to find some case law on that specific issue, and I could not find an answer. I do think it's also important to note for purposes of this appeal that the trial court, in the opinion letter on the issue of attorney's fees, said, quote, considering the respective financial situations of each party, we're denying to order fees at this time. And I think that, I don't know if it's clear from that alone, but there were many costs incurred in the actual trial that really were due to appellant's conduct during the trial. And I think if she had income.
You didn't appeal that.
No, Judge, but I think that it's something that this court can consider when deciding whether or not to award fees.
The transcript is not part of our record. Much of what you're talking about is not part of our record.
Right. That one portion was a finding in the court's opinion letter.
Right. But the other multiple appeals, all of those actions we don't have in front of us.
Right. I mean, they are before, some of them are still before this court, but they are.
Not the three of us today.
Correct.
Let me ask you this. The statute requires the court to identify the factors in subsection E which support the court's order and include those in written findings. What factors do you think the court considered or relied upon in deciding the amount of spousal support?
Judge, in our brief, we go through each one, but I think that it's clear from the opinion letter that the court really does consider each factor. I'll acknowledge that the court does not specify each factor and link it to the evidence that was presented. But if you look, especially at the first, the court does like an opening summary in the opinion letter, and it addresses the fact, despite what Ms. Robinson said, it addresses in there that wife was a stay-at-home mother since 2005, that she had worked. It addresses...
Don't those findings support an increased award of spousal support instead of a reduced amount?
No, Judge. I think one of the main reasons is because at pendente lite, the court didn't impute any income to wife, where at the final trial there was an imputation of income, so that's a significant difference. I think also when you look at the parties' contributions to the marriage, the court spends a great deal of time talking about how husband was laid off from his job in the Richmond area. He couldn't find other employment in Virginia. He had to relocate to New Jersey. Wife simply refused to relocate to New Jersey, so he commuted back and forth for several years, which I think is an 8-hour drive. So I think the court considered the parties' monetary contributions, their non-monetary contributions. The court clearly considered the standard of living and really all of the factors in its opinion letter.
Is at least when I did the calculation, the $4,500 per month versus the $7,200 per month is 62.5% of the original. Now it's certainly got case law that says that's a pendente lite award. This is the first decision of the court of a permanent, if you will, spousal award.
Correct.
So you need change of circumstance or whatever. But to follow on Judge Petty's question, given the expenses that were noted and the lifestyle that had occurred, what other discussion of the factors is there? Certainly the points you just made.
Mm-hmm.
You made the points about the move to New Jersey and she didn't want to go, and the offer. I think you also talked about offering to move to them to Boston and to buy their house and that sort
Correct.
Of thing. And she didn't want to do that. But what other things, given the expenses and his, encouraging her to be a stay-at-home mother,
mm-hmm.
can you cite to the court from the record that we have before us?
To show that the court properly calculated the spouse's
yes.
support amount.
It's such a big difference.
Yes, Judge. The court also pointed out the high living expenses for the husband living in New Jersey and also supporting his parents. Another expense that husband has is that the trial court, in the opinion letter, ruled that he was to pay his income percentage of the child's private school tuition. So that's another expense that he has.
That's a 7129
Correct.
Expenditure difference.
Correct. The court also talked about both parties' health, that despite the deep vein thrombosis, that wife is able to work. Again, the lifestyle of the parties and the contributions to the marriage, I think they were all discussed. Was there any factor that the court felt like the trial court should have addressed?
He didn't list them all. And he didn't say specifically, did he, that he was considering them all, at least in the opinion letter. We don't know about it from the transcript.
He did, Judge. I will acknowledge, I think there's a typographical error in the opinion letter, because in the spousal support section, the court says, I have considered all the factors in 20-107.3. And I believe that's a typographical error.
It was the 21.1.
Correct.
Where is this? I'm sorry.
It's page 29 of the appendix
right.
under spousal support. And again, despite that code section, I think it's clear from reading throughout the whole opinion letter that he does, that the court did consider all
of. He considers the factors in Virginia Code section 20-108.1. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. I think that's.
Under spousal support, yes.
Right.
So it doesn't say all the factors. It doesn't quite have this code section correct, but it did 108.1, presumably it's 107.1, I see what your argument.
Right. And again, in our brief, we go through each factor and point out how it's mentioned in the opinion letter, even though it may not be directly under that section. Again, I do think that the record is clear, even just based on the opinion letter, that the trial court's decision was proper and that it certainly wasn't an abuse of discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think you have your. I'm not sure whether our time. I think our timer was off, so you still have your 4 minutes remaining for rebuttal.
Yes. Thank you.
I was looking through the appendix again, and I noticed the monthly income and expense sheet is included, but the exhibit itself, the document, does not indicate that it was presented to the trial court. It's not initialed by the trial court. There's no exhibit number on it. It looks like it's just an income. How do I determine whether this was actually presented for the trial court's consideration?
If it was not initialed by the trial court, sir, I don't know if this court can believe that it was, in fact, an exhibit submitted, but I can only tell the court that, yes, it was submitted as an exhibit, having lost control of the exhibit itself once it is submitted to the trial court. We don't know whether it's initialed or how it is stamped. That's the unfortunate part of what happens during the course of a trial, where you have had, sure, almost 100 exhibits submitted to the trial court for labeling as well as for making it a part of the record.
But I take it you didn't attach anything in the joint appendix that wasn't in the court's file.
We absolutely did not, sir. Absolutely nothing.
But normally, what we would do, and I know oftentimes in these cases that exhibits are admitted by agreement, or they're included in a notebook of exhibits that is admitted in bulk. But normally what we can do is look back to the transcript of the trial and see that was in fact done.
Yes,
sir. That's, again, one of the concerns I have is we just don't know what happened at trial. We don't know what exhibits were presented because there's no transcript.
Yes, sir. But the summation of what happened in the trial in all the exhibits that were submitted to the trial court or a part of this court's record, because all of it is warehoused in the court's January 19th opinion letter and what that court did upon. And this is what brings us here today. The opinion letter is remarkably void in calculating, or how it got to calculate, the spousal support on a monthly basis. And this brings us to why we're here today also. The appellee wants to add one additional bill to the appellate, even though her earning capacity is still no longer really an earning capacity, and that is asking this court for attorney's fees. Well, after the second notice of appeal was filed with this court, there was also a motion that was filed to try to consolidate all the issues so everything would come before the court in a neat little package. But very briefly, may I crunch some numbers for you, sir, which brings us to today and why we are here today. And that is, number one, all the factors in 107.1, particularly E and F, are not in the opinion letter, so we don't know how these...
But how do you respond to Ms. Fitzgerald's point that she just made, that it says on page 4 of the opinion letter, 29 of the appendix, in determining the amount, the court considers the factors in Virginia Code section 20-108.1, it gets 108 rather than 107.
The court may have considered it, but then you have the trial court is supposed to go through, under the Berryhill case, through a tickler list and place every factor, in fact, that it has heard as a part of the evidence to the factors to that statute. And this didn't happen.
But you do concede that the best way to read that line in Judge Wallerstein's opinion is that's a typo and it really references 20-107.
Absolutely. It is a typo. It should be 20-107.1. Absolutely, sir.
Thank you very much. You've used your time, and we thank you for your argument. We'll recount, and then we'll take a brief recess.